Not yet. Go live. All right. Good morning. We are attempting to go live on Facebook, and then we are also going to record a backup. So if you would find Mark 16, I don't even really know what to call this yet, because I just, on Facebook, I just titled it Something Strange About Codex Sinaiticus, or Sinaiticus. And for now, that's basically what I'm calling it. But if you would look in your Bible at Mark 16. In my Bible, if I look at verse 8, it says, And when they went out quickly and fled from the sepulchre, they trembled and were amazed. Neither said they anything to any man, for they were afraid. And then I have a notation on the beginning of verse 9. Okay, I have a Roman numeral number 1. I'm in a Scofield Reference Bible. And that takes me down to a footnote on that page. Okay, and it says in the footnote, it says, the passage from verse 9 to the end is not found in the two most ancient manuscripts, the Sinaitic and the Vatican. And others have it with partial omissions and variations, but it is quoted by Irenaeus, Hippolytus in the third century. Okay? So, the reason I had you go there first is because the footnote and the removal of the passage from verse 9 to verse 20 in some modern versions, most modern versions will not remove it altogether. They will offset it somehow with a line or some sort of offsetting that will indicate then with a footnote that they don't believe the passage should be there. And one of the reasons they don't believe the passage should be there is because the two so-called oldest and best manuscripts don't have from verse 9 to verse 20 in them. Okay? Now, I have called up here on the screen, this is CodexSinaiticus.org. Okay? And I'll say a little bit more about that in a minute. But I do want to show you what I'm talking about here just quickly. So I apologize for those of you that are on these cameras. So I'm going to go up here and change this. And I'm going to go to Mark. And I'm going to go to chapter 16. And I want to show you on the screen what I'm talking about. Okay? So it's going to load Mark 16. So this is an image, this is a digitized image of Mark chapter 16. Actually, what I need to do to show you is go to Luke chapter 1. Sorry about that. So I want you to see visually why that footnote says that, okay? So, and I can zoom in on that a little bit so that you can see that better. So this is the end of Mark 16. This is the end of verse 8. This is Codex Sinaiticus, okay? Here's the beginning of Luke. You see this blank spot right here? Okay? This blank spot right there is where you would have enough space for verses 9 through what? For verses 9 through 20, okay? So that footnote in the Scofield Reference Bible is saying that verses 9 through 20 shouldn't be in there, in part because they're not in that what? They're not in that manuscript. Never mind the fact that they're in virtually every other manuscript that we have, and that the church fathers quote them as early as the 2nd and the 3rd century. So based on the authority and part of this particular codex, some are saying these verses shouldn't even be there. Let me show you another thing. Come over to Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5. Now these are just some very basic things, okay? My notes are not like they normally are. I just have handwritten stuff here to myself to just remind myself to talk about certain things. So Matthew chapter 5, look at verse 22. Matthew chapter 5, verse 22. In the King James Bible it says, "But I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a what? Without a cause." Okay? Modern versions leave out the phrase "without a cause." The reason they leave the phrase "without a cause" out is because that phrase is not found in Codex Sinaiticus. So on the basis of one lone witness, even Codex Vaticanus has the phrase in Greek "without a cause" in it. So they are leaving that phrase out of the English Bible, of the modern versions of the English Bible, based upon the witness of Codex Sinaiticus. Okay? So they are making wholesale changes They're making wholesale changes to the text in some cases based upon the witness of only one codex. This particular one up here, Codex Sinaiticus. Is it not working? If it does, then you might have to hit go live again. So, anyway, we're still getting the recording on this one, right? Okay. So what I want to do today is kind of talk to you sort of more informally. I want to have an informal discussion about the age and the antiquity of Codex Sinaiticus. So I just want to, my point in starting by talking about Mark 16 and Matthew chapter 5 is just to give you the understanding that what we're going to talk about has a direct impact on what you have in front of you in English. Okay? So this is not just some obscure Greek thing that, you know, it doesn't affect or impact anything with relationship to the English Bible. So there are decisions that are being made to leave stuff out or exclude certain portions or parts of verses based upon one codex alone, okay? So the first thing I want to do is I want to talk to you a little bit about my personal history with this, okay? So today is June what, 4th?
4th.
Okay? Becky went in for surgery on April 3rd, so basically 2 months ago she went in for surgery. That's when I had spring break. Just before spring break, I saw an advertisement for a book on the internet called Neither Oldest Nor Best by Dr. David Sorensen. Okay? And I'm like, oh, that looks interesting. This just came out in 2017. I mean, this thing was hot off the press. And I really had no idea necessarily what the book was about, but I know that we've been studying things about the King James Bible, and this was it seemed like a relevant thing to read, and it was relatively short, and I thought I could read it during the time frame that Becky was recuperating. So I ordered one, and it came the Sunday before she went in for surgery. So when we went to the hospital that day, I took this book with me, and I started reading it while I was waiting for her in surgery and recovery and so on and so forth, okay? Well, I finished it in 2 days. And when I first started reading it, I could not believe, because I didn't really know what was in it, right? I knew he was going to say that they're neither oldest or best, but I didn't really think too much about what might be in it. But as I started to read it, I was blown away, because what he was saying was that Codex Sinaiticus was a 19th century creation, that it wasn't old, that it was written by a guy named Constantine Simonides in 1840, and that it had been sort of foisted upon the academic world, and that the entire codex was a fraud. So, you know, I went to Bible college, and I learned all about textual the critical theory and so forth, and I also learned from Brother Jordan the pro-King James theories and stuff like that. But I had never, ever encountered the idea that the codex itself was not an ancient codex, and that it was a modern creation and so forth. So at first, as I'm reading this, I'm sort of like, yeah, right. You know, I'm very skeptical. And by the time I was done with it, by the second day, I was sitting there scratching my head, thinking, okay, I think there might be something to this. So what I did is, as soon as I finished it, I got on the phone and I called Dave Reed. And I said, Dave, you need to order this book, and you need to read it, and you need to pick it apart from the point of view of a lawyer. Okay? I want you to cross-examine it, and I want you to pick it apart from the point of view of a lawyer. So Dave got a copy of the book, and within a week, he had read it. So we had both had read it, and we began discussing what was in it. Then the next thing that we did is we started pilfering the footnotes and the bibliography of this book, and we found our way to some other things too, okay? The second thing is a Kindle book. It's only available in Kindle, and it's called Forging Codex Sinaiticus by a guy named William Cooper. So we read that next, okay? And then we started discussing that. And then we found our way to Codex. This was written in 1983, Codex Sinaiticus and the Constantine Simonides Affair, okay? So the point here is, as you start down this trail, you start realizing that this is not just some crackpot King James-only scheme that has, you know, been invented within the last 2 years, but that the authenticity and the antiquity of the codex was something that was actually debated for a period of 3 to 4 years in the British journals in the 1860s, okay? All this stack right here, this is a printed stack of only one theological journal from Britain from 1859. I have printouts from 1859 to 1864, announcing the discovery of Codex Sinaiticus by Tischendorf in 1859, and then in 1862, 63, and 64, a robust discussion in the British newspapers and theological journals of whether or not the Codex was in fact actually ancient. Okay, so this is not something that is. It was wholly unknown to me before April 1st, but it is not something that is just made up and of recent origin as far as a discussion point by people that support the King James. This was an actual debate of things that were going on. So in addition to reading these three books, I now have assembled in 2 months all this information and data that you see up here on the podium, plus a whole bunch more in an online Dropbox folder that Dave Reed and I are sharing. And so the amount of information and relevant data that's out there on this has been completely astounding to me, that we've been able to make the kind of headway that we've been able to make in the time frame that we've made it. Now, I have to also give credit not only to the three books that I just mentioned, and by the way, the book here by Eliot, the Codex Sinaiticus and the Simonides Affair, this one is very anti-Simonides. That he was lying, that he was a forger, that he wasn't telling the truth, and it is not favorable, and it is it's not favorable towards Simonides and the idea that it was created in 1840. Okay, but in addition to that, there is a video that was put out in 2013 by a guy named Chris Pinto, and this video is on YouTube. It's about 3 hours long. It's called "Wheat Among the Tares," and he kind of is the one through this video who got a discussion going about this. Subsequent to the video, Chris Pinto debated James White. So I've watched Chris Pinto's video. I've listened to the debate between James White and Chris Pinto about this topic. I've read Chris Pinto's follow-up. I've listened to James White's follow-up. And I've also listened to Dr. Daniel Wallace's video on Codex Sinaiticus. And in addition to that, as a result of Chris Pinto's video, Wheat Among the Tares, in 2013, in 2015 and 16, David W. Daniels from Chick Publications has done a series of 36 vlogs on the Chick Publication YouTube page talking about something strange about Codex Sinaiticus. And in addition to that, there's a researcher named Steve Avery who has a group page on Facebook, and then he also has a discussion forum where these matters are being discussed. Okay, so I say all that to say that this is like a real thing that is being discussed right now. This is not just something that's some goofy thing. Okay, now one of the reasons why I think that this has become an issue again, if I can get this thing to wake up. One of the reasons I think this thing has become an issue is because in 2009, the British Library decided to digitize the entire Codex. Okay? So what they did is they took high-resolution digital photographs of Codex Sinaiticus and they published them online. Okay? Now, what this did, frankly, is it allowed scholars and so forth, who had never actually seen the Codex, to actually look at it themselves. Okay? Up to this point, most people were using facsimile reprints and stuff like this. They had never actually seen the actual Codex itself. Okay? So this happens in 2009. In 2013, Chris Pinto releases his video, Wheat Among the Tares, and this whole thing starts percolating a discussion here and research now that has penetrated pretty deep into this particular topic. Okay? So, The idea that Codex Sinaiticus is not a 4th century ancient codex, again, it's not some crackpot King James only theory here, okay? This is something that was debated heavily, okay? And as I already showed you, this is just from one journal. This is the Journal of Sacred Literature and the Biblical Record. There was a newspaper called The Guardian. There was another thing called The Literary Churchman. There was at least one other paper and periodical that was debating back and forth whether or not Tischendorf was telling the truth or whether or not Constantine Simonides was telling the truth. And I'll say more about those guys in a minute. Okay? So there was the robust public debate in the British press, and then a different scholar in 1907 wrote a book called Literary Forgeries. Okay? James Farrar, J.A. Farrar, wrote Literary Forgeries in 1907. He's got an entire chapter in this book about Constantine Simonides and Codex Sinaiticus. Okay? And he concludes the following. He says, "The question, therefore, pending regarding how old the Codex is, pending the acquisition of further evidence, must remain among the interesting but unsolved mysteries of literature." So even a guy like James Farrar, after evaluating all the data from the 1860s, all he could say is that it's undecided, barring the discovery of further information. Okay? So I'm sharing that with you to let you know that the stuff that I'm going to go over here is not necessarily new information as far as its availability. I think it is new in the sense that a new discussion and a debate has arose, and I think largely due to the digitizing of the Codex and the putting it online where people now could actually see it. Okay. Does anybody have any questions so far?
Just for the benefit of the order, what is a codex?
Okay, that's not my thing to talk about. A codex is a codex is an ancient. It's basically a word to refer to a book. Okay. So a codex basically equals a book, which means it's not a scroll, and it's not just loose pieces of papyrus. It is a collection of quires that are put together and then that are put together under covers like a modern book would be. So it's an early form of a book. So if you look at this page, you can see here that there's a crease where the previous leaf was. Okay? That's because the codex is made up of a whole bunch of different quires. If you look up here, you can see that you can list the quire, that's the set of pages that are stitched together, and then the folia or the folio are the individual leaves within that particular quire. So the codex is a collection of leaves which make quires, which make the whole codex. So it's a form of a book. Yeah.
How was it originally dated? How did they date it?
Okay, so they date it based upon what is called paleography. I don't know if this is spelled exactly right, but paleography is basically the study of ancient handwriting. So Tischendorf finds it, and he says, "Oh well, based upon the style of the handwriting, the fact that different features, this has to be a fourth century codex, right?" So I should add that it has never been tested scientifically. They had a test scheduled where they were going to have the codex tested forensically to try to determine the age of the parchment and the ink and all that sort of business. And the test was canceled. They never went through with the test. The British Museum, they had it all lined up, and then they never go through with the test. And what I'm more interested in doing here is kind of dealing with facts and not speculation. Now, the reason I say that is I think that some of these books are far too speculative. Okay? They want to see Jesuit conspiracies and all this sort of thing hiding underneath every rock. And so what they've done is they've sort of clouded up the facts of the case and made it easy for people like James White to just concentrate on the conspiratorial aspect and say, this is crazy, look at this conspiracy theory, blah, 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 and never really deal with the facts of the case. Okay? So as I've thought about this, and as Dave Reed and I have discussed it, what we have decided is more important is to focus on the facts, and then worry about how you might explain the facts after we've laid out the facts. Does that make sense? Because otherwise, you get all bogged down in all this stuff that you can't prove. It's better to start with what you can prove, and therefore try to figure out how to explain what you can prove, than to come up with some sort of theory out of the gate, and then lose everybody from the outset. Okay, so any other questions? Yeah, Brad.
But the age of it really is only a minor portion of whether we would consider it.
That's a great point, and I meant to say that and I forgot. It doesn't matter to me how old it is, because I already reject it as a witness based upon the principles that we established in this class, based upon the principles of availability and the fact that it's in use, or the fact that it wasn't in use, and the idea of the majority or the multiplicity of copies, those three principles that we established. It doesn't matter to me whether it's a 4th century codex or whether it's a 19th century codex. I reject the readings in it based upon a scriptural evaluation of the codex itself. Okay? Now, that being said, if it is in fact not what they said it was, this would be catastrophic to the critical theory. Okay? So I've already rejected the critical theory based upon scriptural principles before I even read any of this stuff. So I'm not staking it on, I don't need it to be a certain age to know that I would never accept it as the preserved text. Does that make sense? We good with that? So let's talk about a couple facts here. So, first of all, it's a codex. That means it's a book. It includes some. So these are facts about Codex Sinaiticus. It includes some of the Old Testament. It is complete. It has a complete New Testament. And in addition, it includes New Testament Apocrypha books. It includes the Epistle of Barnabas. And it includes the Shepherd of Hermas. Okay? And the entire codex is not known to have existed until 1844. Okay? So I'm going to try to draw some stuff out here in the form of a crude timeline. Okay? So, and I'm going to put 1844 right about here. In 1844, Constantine von Tischendorf, he goes to St. Catherine's Monastery. St. Catherine's Monastery at the foot of Mount Sinai. And he reports to find what he calls a rubbish bin in the middle of the library of the monastery that the monks are setting aside to burn stuff as kindling for the fire that they're burning to warm the monastery. Okay, and he finds what he thinks is an ancient codex, and he asks the monks if he can take it, and they say no. Okay, now I'm making a very complicated story as simple as I can, okay? But he leaves with 43 leaves of the Codex in 1844, okay? And he takes them to Leipzig, Germany. And the reason he takes them to Leipzig, Germany is because the Germans have financed this trip. So he's got to bring something back to the dudes that are financing the trip, right? And so he brings this back, and this becomes known, these 43 leaves become known as CFA, Codex Frederico Augustanus. He names it after the guy who financed the trip, who was basically the leader of Germany at that particular time, right? So he discovers 43 leaves the first time in 1844, okay? He goes back again in 1853 and gets nothing. And then he goes back a third time in 1859 where he finds the remaining 315 leaves of the Codex, and he takes them back with him to ultimately to St. Petersburg, Russia. Okay? Now, so this becomes known as CFA, Codex Frederico Augustanus. This ultimately becomes known as Codex what? This ultimately becomes known as Codex Sinaiticus. Okay? And he gets the rest of it in 1859. So he comes three times. He goes He goes once in 1844 and gets the first 43 leaves. He goes a second time in 1853 and gets nothing. And he goes a third time in 1859 where he discovers the rest of it. And he basically, excuse me, but lies to the monks and takes the thing back with him to St. Petersburg, Russia. Because the third time he goes, he's going under the auspices of the Russian Tsar. And so he takes it back to St. Petersburg. Okay? In the 1930s, the British Museum purchased from the Soviet Union that was cash-strapped in the 1930s. The British Museum purchases the St. Petersburg portion, and that's how it ends up in the British Museum. Okay? Now, if I go back to this website, got to wake it back up. If I go back to the website, and I'll show you that this project is a combination effort between the British Museum and the University of Leipzig. And now the whole thing signed me out. That's perfect. Okay? So I'm going to... Hopefully. Amen. So I'm going to go back to the home page. And I'll show you what I'm talking about. Because it's important. See this right here? Partner institutions. The British Library, the National Library of Russia, St. Catherine's Monastery, and Leipzig University. Okay? So all the digitized images that you find at the website are the combined effort of all of these institutions. Okay? Now the reason for that is because part of it, to this day, is still in Leipzig, Germany. The first 43 leaves. The majority of it was in St. Petersburg before they sold it to who? Before they sold it to the British in the 1930s. Okay? So, this is the standard story of Tischendorf. Okay? So nobody knows about the Codex at all until what year? 1844, right? It is undiscovered. It's sitting in St. Catherine's Monastery since who knows how long, until Tischendorf discovers it and then comes back in a decade, over 15 or 16 years later, and he gets the rest of it. And then he publishes in the early 1860s. He publishes, I think it's actually 62, he's going to publish a facsimile of what's in the library in St. Petersburg, okay? So that's why the National Library of Russia is on here, because he takes it where? He takes it to St. Petersburg first. Okay? Now, is everybody clear on that? Seriously, are there any questions on that basic time frame? Yeah.
Did you find that in the rubbish bin they were going to burn the first time?
Here?
Yes.
That's what he claims.
So they decided not to burn it?
So then what he claims is, once the monk that him asking about it raises their suspicion that it might be valuable. So they thought it was a worthless piece of trash, according to Tischendorf. And they've got it in this thing, in this collection bin, waiting to burn it, until he shows up, realizes it's this old ancient codex, asks about it. This arises the suspicion of the monks. And then the monks, they don't really want him to take anything, but he basically takes 43 leaves back to Leipzig, Germany. Okay? So now he knows it's there. So he comes in 1853, he doesn't find it, and he comes in 1859 where he recovers the majority of the codex. Okay? Is everybody with that?
So he stole it, in other words.
I would say he stole it. And I will say this, even Dr. Daniel Wallace at Dallas Theological Seminary, as well as a host of other people at the time, in the 1860s when this was being debated, thought he was lying about how he obtained it. So for me to say Tischendorf was not telling the truth is not a new idea either. There were many people, even at the time, that thought he was not telling the truth about how he obtained the codex. Okay? Now, where this gets interesting is in 1862, another Constantine named Constantine Simonides writes the Guardian newspaper in August 1862 and says that what Tischendorf has discovered and what he is fixing to publish is not an ancient 4th century codex, but that him, his uncle Benedict, and a couple other monks created it in 1840 in Mount Athos, Greece, as an intended gift for the Tsar of Russia, who was the patronage of the monastery Pentelion on Mount Athos, Greece. He writes to the British paper in August 1862 and says, what Tischendorf found is not old. I created it in 1840 in Mount Athos, Greece, with my uncle Benedict and a couple other people, as an intended gift to the Tsar of Russia, in the hopes that the Tsar of Russia would give to the monastery a printing press. Okay? So from 1862, for 3 years, from 1862 to 1864, this becomes argued and debated in the British press. And that's what this is right here, this stack of stuff I showed you from the 1860s. Okay? So Simonides is claiming that it's not what?
Ancient.
That it's not ancient. Okay? Is everybody with that? So, I'm already running out of time, and this is just not going well. So let's talk about... So what I want to do is I want to talk to you about some facts. Okay? And in order to do that, I got to wake this dumb thing back up again. So I already told you two of the distinguishing features of this codex is that they contain the Epistle of Barnabas and the Shepherd of Hermas in Greek. Okay? They are bound to the codex. They are part of the codex. So I'm going to go back up here and I'm going to go back and see the manuscript. And if I go to the listing, you can see you can pick what you want to look at. I'm going to go all the way to the end. And you can see that listed are what? Barnabas and what? And Hermas. Okay? So two of the distinguishing features of the codex is that bound hard to the codex, what that means is included in it are a Greek copy of Barnabas and a Greek copy of what? Shepherd of Hermas. Okay? Now that's important. So I'm going to click first on Hermas, because I'm going to talk about that first. I think. So this is the beginning of Hermas. This is the beginning of the Shepherd of Hermas. So this is the last thing that's found in the codex. Okay, so I'm just going to have that picture up there. So let me give you some facts about Hermas. Number one, Hermas, Shepherd of Hermas, is bound to the codex. That means it was a part of what Tischendorf found in 1859. Okay. Number two, that means that it is of the same age and provenance. Provenance is a fancy word to say place of origin or earliest known history. Okay? So that means that, like it or not, for good or for bad, are these two things attached to that codex. Okay? So they're bound to the codex and they're of the same age and provenance as the rest of it. Okay? They are written on the same vellum, and they are also written in the same ink. All right? And they are also written in modern Greek, i.e. medieval to 19th century Greek. So the words, some of the Greek words, and I'll go over this in a minute, some of the Greek words contained in Hermas are not known to have existed in ancient Greek, but they do exist in modern Greek. Is everybody with that? Okay. I wanted to say up here that this is a uncial codex, which means that it is all capital letters. And I also wanted to say that it is written on vellum, which is animal skins. Okay. Not papyrus or something like that. So, is everybody with me so far? I'm not going to get all this done, which I know you're all really surprised about. So let me just do Hermas. Okay, so Blake's not. He was already razzing me about this last night. 1855. Now this is where it gets interesting, okay? 1855-56. Simonides shows up in Leipzig, Germany with a Greek copy of Hermas. Has Tischendorf found it yet?
No.
So Simonides, the guy who later on is going to claim to have written Codex Sinaiticus in 1840, he shows up in Leipzig, Germany in 1855 with a copy of Hermas in Greek. Is everybody with that? Okay. No one, before Simonides shows up, no one had ever seen a Greek copy of Hermas before this point. No one had ever seen it, okay? What is known to have existed, it's known to have originated in Greek, but the only copies that survived history were Latin copies of the Shepherd of Hermas in various ages and conditions. So they know that it was originally written in Greek, but no known Greek manuscript of the Shepherd of Hermas had what?
Survived,
right? In 1855-56, Simonides shows up in Leipzig, Germany with a copy of the Shepherd of Hermas in Greek. So what I'm basically going to say to you is that the smoking guns of the age of the Codex end up to be these apocryphal books right here. Okay, now let me explain further what I mean by that. Two professors, so as soon as Simonides shows up, two professors, Anger and Dindorf, two German professors, set about producing a printed edition of the Shepherd of Hermas in Greek, along with a scholarly apparatus provided by Simonides. So they start the project of putting this thing in writing, this Greek copy of the Shepherd of Hermas, and it is actually, he shows up in 1855, and it's actually published in 1856. Okay, everybody with that? Our buddy Tischendorf starts observing it. Okay, and he decides, Tischendorf declares it to be a fake. Okay? Not a copy of the original Greek, but a back translation from 14th century Latin. So in 1856, Tischendorf says that the thing is what? A fake and a back translation from Latin. Okay? Now, let me just say a few things, more things about that. Tischendorf would have known what he was talking about on this point because his first claim to fame was he made a back translation of Jerome's Vulgate. Okay? So he knows he has already done this where he's taken a Latin thing and translated it back into what? Into Greek, right? So he would know, he would be able to identify quote-unquote Latinisms, which would be instances where the Greek word was clearly a translation of a Latin what? Of a Latin word. And Tischendorf would be able to recognize this because way back before he discovers anything, he makes a translation of the Latin Vulgate from Latin into Greek. So he does basically the exact opposite of what Erasmus did in the 1500s. But that's a different topic, right? So he would have been able to spot these Latinisms pretty easily. Okay? Now, you understand now the ultimate problem for Tischendorf. Because in 1856, he calls Simonides' copy of Hermas a what? A fake. Right? But in 1859, he discovers Codex Sinaiticus, and what's in the Codex? A Greek Hermas. Is everybody with that? Okay? So in 1859, Tischendorf, when he finds Codex Sinaiticus, it contains a Greek copy of Hermas that was practically identical with the one produced by Simonides in 1856. Now you see the problem here, right? He wants the world to believe that what he's found is what? Ancient. In what he found is a Greek copy of what? Hermas. The Greek copy of Hermas that's in Codex Sinaiticus is an almost identical match to the one Simonides published in 1856, which Tischendorf has already said is what? A fake. Uh-oh. Okay? Now, 1864, the scholar Donaldson, James Donaldson, I don't know, probably maybe a relation, I don't know. James Donaldson writes a book called A Critical History of Christian Literature and Doctrine. Okay? And in this book, he's got an entire section where he is talking about the connection between the Greek Hermes found in Codex Sinaiticus and the one that Tischendorf has already pronounced to be a fake in 1856. Is everybody with me? Okay? Well, let's just look at a couple of the tidbits here. He says that the Hermes attached to Codex Sinaiticus is substantially the same as the Athos edition published by Simonides in 1856. So here's a scholar saying what? That they're virtually what? The same. And remember, when he showed up in Germany, no one had ever seen Hermes before in what? In Greek. Now, it just so happens that that Greek matches almost nearly identically with the Greek that Tischendorf finds in 1859. And he later says that he did what? That he wrote the Codex. Is everybody with that? There's a lot of different points here. And again, these are not, as I said, these are not my normal notes. If I were giving you normal notes, I would have all these quotes typed out for you so that you could see them. But he says in page 110... This is what he says, talking about, I'm getting ahead of myself. Let me go back to my notes. So Donaldson, the late origin of the Greek Hermes found in Codex Sinaiticus is betrayed by the following, okay? Number one, or A, words unknown to classical Greek, but common in later Greek. Okay? Number two, there are grammar issues that would indicate that it is a modern Greek grammar, not an ancient Greek what? Grammar, and Donaldson talks about all of this in his book. Third, it's not the Greek of the first five centuries of the Christian era. And four, Latinisms, the words that were translated from Latin. So this is what Donaldson says. At the bottom of page 310, he says, all these examples have been taken from the Sinaitic Greek. But the arguments become tenfold stronger if the Sinaitic Greek is to stand or fall with the Athos Greek. And this must be, for they are substantially the same. Now, you everybody understand what he just said? He said that the Greek copy of Hermes in Codex Sinaiticus is substantially the same as the Greek copy of Hermes that was already published by Constantine Simonides in 1856. Okay, and he says that if you take them, whatever the arguments are for Codex Sinaiticus, that it is of recent origin or modern origin, are magnified tenfold when you compare them to the Greek of Hermes. That's what Donaldson's saying. And by the way, who's already said that's a fake? Tischendorf. Okay? So Donaldson is almost immediately attacked for saying the same things about the Hermes found in Codex Sinaiticus that Tischendorf said about Simonides' Hermes. Okay? So, I don't have time to read all this to you, but here it is right here, the Saturday Review, Politics, Literature, Science, and Art. This is from 1875, where they do a character assassination job on Donaldson for pointing out that the Greek is what? The same, right? So let me back up. Donaldson writes this one in 1864. In 1874, he updates it with new information, including the Epistle of Barnabas. The following year, there's a character assassination job in the British press on Donaldson for daring to question whether or not, for daring to point out the fact that there's a linkage in the Greek and Hermes between Simonides' edition and the Codex Sinaiticus. Is everybody with that? Now, why are they so mad about this in 1875? Why are they so mad about this? Because the revision committee is already meeting and has already adopted Codex Sinaiticus as the most ancient complete Bible in the history of the world, and is placing extreme weight and authority on what it has to say. And here comes a guy saying, wait a minute, it's not what? Is everybody with that? I'm getting blank stares. It's got me scared a little bit. What? You with that? Okay. So Donaldson's pieces, the two right here, the one from 64 and then the expanded one from 74, Donaldson's two pieces, they come at the time when the Committee for the Revised Version has already begun meeting and working on the project and swapping out the Textus Receptus with this new critical text that's being developed by Westcott and Hort. Okay? So, no, regarding the hit job on Donaldson, no competent linguist or scholar ever challenged Donaldson's analysis. Okay? Number two. Instead, he is personally attacked, and in most notably in the Saturday Review. Okay? So Donaldson's review of Codex Sinaiticus, of the Greek of Hermas, leads to the conclusion that the Hermas in Codex Sinaiticus was also a modern production, along with the one produced by who? Simonides in 1856. So Donaldson is saying, look, there is a linkage between these that you cannot avoid. Because of the grammar, because of the Greek, the modern Greek words that are in there that aren't found in ancient Greek, and also because of the Latinisms. Okay? So Donaldson's review leads to the conclusion that Hermas and Codex Sinaiticus was also a modern production along with Simonides. Now, this is almost too much. Okay? Tischendorf is forced to backpedal. He's already said this is a what?
Okay.
A fake. But now the same thing that's here is in what? Is in this. Well, if this is a fake and a modern creation, but the exact same thing virtually is in this, well then what does it say about this? That this would also be a modern what? Creation. So Tischendorf is now going to be forced to backpedal on what he said about the Athos edition that Simonides published in 1856. Is everybody following that? Okay, now let me just say a few things about that. Tischendorf is forced to backpedal in order to try to save his enterprise. He was forced to admit that Simonides' Hermas of 1856 was in fact ancient. Possibly even the original. After he's already said it's what?
Fake.
A fake. Okay? Because he knows if he doesn't do that, what's that mean about this? That's also a fake. Okay? So he does this. So he totally reverses his course. He says that the edition of Simonides' Hermas in 1856 was in fact ancient, possibly even the original, and he does this despite the modern characteristics and Latinisms that he himself had already what? Identified. He'd already made the case for why it wasn't ancient and a modern creation, and now he's reversing his whole opinion on that because he knows if he doesn't, this is going to what? That's going to be in trouble, at least in pawning it off as an ancient codex. So, he argues that Simonides' Hermas had to be redated given the obvious antiquity of Codex Sinaiticus. So he says, well, we can see that this is clearly what? Ancient, but it matches this, so therefore this must be what? Ancient, and I was wrong. Is everybody with that? So he says, let me just read that. He argues, Tischendorf argues, that Simonides' Hermas had to be redated given the obvious antiquity of the codex. If it was found in Sinaiticus, it couldn't be modern. And the entire academic world closed ranks around Tischendorf. Okay? Hort, Westcott, Tregellis, all those guys, They all close ranks around Tischendorf, and they never bring up the fact that he's making these points. So, the retraction, Tischendorf's retraction, was printed in Latin. Now, why would he do that? He printed it in Latin if he didn't really want anybody to what? To read it, okay? It's printed in Latin in an obscure German journal. And so it's extremely difficult for anybody in the English-speaking world even to obtain, much less what? Read. So Tischendorf had been... Now here's the thing, here's the ironic thing. Tischendorf had been correct on every point in criticizing Simonides. Donaldson demonstrates that in those two works I just showed you. Tischendorf had been correct in every point in critiquing Simonides' Hermes, but he was forced to deny everything he had said in order to argue that the Greek of both Hermeses, or Hermi, I don't know how you... was, in fact, the original what? Word. Okay? Now, we don't have time to get into Barnabas, but does everybody kind of see why this thing is anything but a slam dunk deal for why this is old? Okay? The very guy who finds it and says it's an ancient 4th century codex had already in great detail demonstrated that Simonides was not the original, that it was a modern creation, now discovers bound hard to Codex Sinaiticus is the exact same Greek of Hermes that he already declared to be what? A fake. So he retracts his position in Latin in an obscure German journal that, you know, virtually nobody could read. He'd been correct in every single thing that he had said about this, but now he switches his argument. He says, well, this has to be legitimate. This has to be ancient because we all know this is what? Ancient. Okay? Now, it gets even better when you get to Barnabas. But anyway, does anybody have any questions or comments? I want to point out something. I've not said anything about who's doing what, why, and when. I'm just showing you what the facts of the case are. Okay? So the facts of the case seem to point that whoever had access to that Greek also had already had access to it back here. And the guy that publishes the standalone copy is the guy who in 62 says he wrote this all the way back when? Back there. Now we'll get into more, if we can get into a little more of this if you want next time. But we at least have to talk about Barnabas. Okay? Does anybody have any questions or comments?
So why did this guy backtrack?
Who?
Well, that it was fake, and then he said
Tischendorf.
Yeah,
well, he's forced to backtrack.
Yeah,
because why? Because if his critique of this one from 1850 of the Greek Hermes from 1856 is allowed to stand, and he says it's a modern creation, then the exact same arguments that were used to prove this a modern creation from 1856 would have demonstrated this was also a modern what? Creation. Because the same readings that were found in this one were also found where? In this one. So Tischendorf has to backtrack, or else the exact same argumentation that he used to call into question Simonides' edition from 1856 is going to overthrow this as also a modern creation. Is that, you following what I'm saying?
Yeah, but I mean, I still don't think so. Or was it the money?
Well, oh, I see your question now. Tischendorf is, when he comes back with this thing, think about the adulation this guy gets for being the discoverer of the most ancient complete Bible in the history of the world. He has commendations hailed upon him six ways from Sunday by the states of Europe for finding this thing. And he becomes not just Constantine Tischendorf, but he becomes Constantine von Tischendorf, which is a German signification of royalty. So he has a lot at stake in this personally. So his... Now look. You ever watch like these ghost hunter shows? Or the Bigfoot show? You get a bunch of dudes. They go out in the middle of the night looking for Bigfoot in the dark. And every noise they hear has to be what?
Bigfoot.
Can't be anything else. Of course not. Right? One thing I didn't tell you is that the year before he finds anything at St. Catherine's Monastery in 1843, he is called to the Vatican and allowed to examine Codex Vaticanus under the supervision of Cardinal Mai. And then he goes on this worldwide adventure treasure hunt looking for what? Looking for ancient what? Manuscripts. He finds something here that he thinks is significant. He takes 43 pages of it. He clearly comes back again a second time looking for it. And he comes back a third time in 59 trying to find it where he gets the rest of it, right? So... The plot thickens on all this stuff. But it is a historical fact that he met with Cardinal Mai in 1843. Okay. So we're past time, so we need to quit. And I didn't get as far as I wanted to. But does anybody have any questions or comments? You say, who's this Simonides guy? Well... I have right here, from 2014, the University of Vienna, an entire weekend conference on the escapades of Constantine Simonides. An entire weekend symposium at the University of Vienna from 2014, looking into the history and details of Constantine Simonides. This guy, in the Greek world, is something of a hero. Almost a national hero, because he also fought the Ottoman Turks as they were advancing on Greece. So he's really almost like an Indiana Jones type guy. That's kind of what he's like, if I could compare him to something. And he's off doing all this stuff with ancient manuscripts. And I know I've only given you a little bit of the story, but what I want to do is focus on facts. Get the facts out. And then talk about, okay, how do we interpret these facts? Does that make sense? Anybody else have a comment or a question? All right, we will. Do you want to do this again next Sunday?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, we're done.